The Swede would never have imagined that there was anything missing from Jessie's endowment to prevent her from sailing right on through into old age as the laudable mother and lively wife who could make a party for everyone's children out of raking the leaves, and whose 4th of July picnics held on the lawn of the old Orchid estate were a treasured tradition among her friends and neighbors. Her character struck the Swede back then as a compound in which he'd find just about everything toxic to desperation and dread. At the core of her, he could imagine a nucleus of confidence plaited just as neatly and as tightly as her braided hair. Yet hers was another life broken cleanly in two. Now the hair was a ganglion of iron-gray hemp, always in need of brushing, and Jessie was a haggard old woman at 54, an undernourished drunk hiding the bulge of a drunk's belly beneath her shapeless sack dresses. All she could ever find to talk about, on the occasions when she managed to leave the house and go out among people, was the fun she had back before she ever had a drink, a husband, a child, or a single thought in her head. Before she'd been enlivened, as she certainly had looked to him to be, by the stupendous satisfactions of being a dependable person. That people were manifold creatures didn't come as a surprise to the Swede, even if it was a bit of a shock to realize it anew when someone let you down. What was astonishing to him was how people seemed to run out of their own being, run out of whatever the stuff was that made them who they were and drained of themselves, turned into the sort of people they would have once felt sorry for. It was as though, while their lives were rich and full, they were secretly sick of themselves and couldn't wait to dispose of their sanity and their health and all sense of proportion so as to get down to that other self, the true self, who is a wholly deluded fuck-up. It was as though being in tune with life was an accident that might sometimes befall the fortunate young, but was otherwise something for which human beings lacked any real affinity. How odd. And how odd it made him seem to himself to think that he, who had always felt blessed to be numbered among the countless, unembattled normal ones, might, in fact, be the abnormality, a stranger from real life, because of his being so sturdily rooted. "We had a place outside Powley," Jessie was telling his father. "We always raised animals. When I was 7, I got the most wonderful thing. Somebody gave me a pony and a cart. And after that, there was nothing to stop me. I just loved horses. I've ridden all my life. Showed and hunted. Was involved in a drag down there in school in Virginia. When I went to school in Virginia, I was the whip." "Wait a minute," said Mr. LeVar. Whoa. I don't know what a drag and a whip is. Slow down, Mrs. Orcutt. You got a guy from Newark here." She pursed her lips when he called her Mrs. Orcutt, seemingly for his having addressed her as though he were her social inferior, which, the Swede knew, was in part why his father had called her Mrs. Orcutt. But she was Mrs. Orcutt to Lou LeVar, also because of the distancing disdain he had for the drink in her glass, her third scotch and water in under an hour, and the cigarette, her fourth, burning down between the fingers of her trembling hand. He was amazed by her lack of control, by anyone's lack of control, but particularly by the lack of control of the guy who drank. Drink was the devil that lurked in the guy. "Big shot goyim," his father said, "the presidents of companies, and they're like Indians with firewater." "Jessie," she said, "Jessie, please." Her grin painfully artificial, disguising, by the Swede's estimate, about 10% of the agony she now felt at having decided against staying alone at home with her dogs and her TV tray and her own J&B and, in a ridiculous eruption of hope, opting instead for going out like a wife with a husband. At home, there was a phone next to the J&B. She could reach over her glass and pick it up and dial, and even if only half-dressed, she could tell people she knew, without having to face the terror of facing them, how much she liked them. Months might go by without one of Jessie's phone calls, and then she'd phone 3 times after they were already in bed for the night. "Seymour, I'm calling to tell you how much I like you." "Well, Jessie, thank you. I like you too." "Do you?" "Of course I do. You know that." "Yes, I like you, Seymour. I always like you. Did you know I like you?" "Yes, I did. I always admired you. So does Bill. We've always admired you and liked you. We liked Dawn. Well, we like you, Jesse. The night after the bombing, around midnight, after Mary's photograph had been on television and everybody in America knew that the day before she had said to somebody at school that old Rimrock was in for a big surprise, Jesse tried to walk the 3 miles to their house to see the LaVoves, but on the unpaved country road, alone in the dark, had twisted her ankle, and 2 hours later, still lying there, was nearly run over by a pickup truck. Okay, my friend Jesse Philbin, what is a drag and a whip? You couldn't say his father didn't try to get along with people for all that he really couldn't. If she were a guest of his children, then she was his friend. Regardless of how repelled he might be by the cigarettes, by the whiskey, by the unkempt hair, and the run-down shoes, and the burlap tent concealing the ill-used body, by all the privilege she had squandered, and the disgrace she had made of her life. A drag is a hunt, and it's not with a fox. It's over a line that's laid by a man on a horse ahead of you, that has a scent in a bag. It's to make the effect of a hunt. The hounds go after it. There are huge, huge fences, and it's done in a sort of course. It's a lot of fun. You go very fast. Huge, huge, thick brush fences, 8, 10 feet wide, with bars on top. Quite exciting. Down there, there's a lot of steeplechasing and a lot of good riders, and everybody gets out there and bombs through those places, and it's fun. It appeared to the Swede to be as much her confoundment with her predicament, a tipsy woman out at a party, blabbing uncontrollably, as his father's genial, "I'm just a dope" inquiry that drew her disastrously on. Each slurred word unsuccessfully stimulating her mouth to try to produce one that rang clear as a bell. Clear as the daddy that had peeled out perfectly from behind the veil of his daughter, the giant. He knew what his father was thinking without bothering to look up from where he was using the tongs to make a pyramid of the reddest coals. Fun, his father was thinking. What is it with them and fun? What is this fun? What is so much fun? His father was wondering, as he had ever since his son had bought the house in the 100 acres 40 miles west of Keir Avenue, why does he want to live with these people? Forget the drinking. Sober's just as bad. They would bore me to death in 2 minutes. Dawn had one brief against them. His father had another. Anyway, Jesse was saying, trying with the cigarette-holding hand to stir into being some sort of conclusion. That was why I went to school with my horse. You went to school with a horse? Again, she impatiently pursed her lips, probably because this father, who thought he was helping her out with his questions, was driving her even more rapidly than usual to whatever collapse was in store. Yes, we both got on the train at the same time, she told him. Wasn't I lucky? She asked. And to the surprise of both LaVoev men, as though she weren't at all in serious straits, as though that were just a laughable illusion that disgustingly self-satisfied sober people persisted in having about drunks, laid a flirtatious hand on the side of Lou LaVoev's head. I'm sorry, I don't understand how you got on the train with a horse. How big was this horse? In those days, horses were on horse cars. Aha, said Mr. LaVoev, as though his lifelong bewilderment at the pleasures of Gentiles had at last been put to rest. He took a hand from where it lay on his hair, and as though to squeeze into her everything he knew about life's purpose that she would seem to have forgotten, held it firmly between his own hands. Meanwhile, under the impetus of that force which, by failing to size up the situation, would lead her into humiliation before the night was through, Jesse went waveringly on. They were all leaving with the polo circuit, and they were all going down south in the winter train. The train stopped in Philadelphia, so I put my horse in with them. I put my horse in the car, 2 cars up from where I was bunked in, waved goodbye to the family, and it was great. How old were you? I was 13. I didn't feel homesick at all, and it was just great, great. Here she began to cry. Fun. 13, his father was thinking. A bishaka. And you waved goodbye to the family? What was the matter? Was something the matter with them? What the hell were you waving goodbye to your family for at 13? No wonder you're shaken now. But what he said was, that's all right. Let it all out. Why not? You're among friends. Unsavory as the job must have seemed to him, it had to be done. And so he removed the glass from her one hand, discarded for her the freshly lit cigarette in the other, and took her into his arms, which was perhaps all she had been asking for all along. "I see where I have to be a father again," he said to her softly, and she could say nothing. She could only weep and let herself be rocked by the Swede's father whom, on the one other occasion she had met him in her life, when some 15 years back they had gone to picnic on the Orcutt's lawn for 4th of July, she had tried to interest in skeet shooting, yet another of those diversions that had long defied Lulabov's Jewish comprehension. For fun, pulling a trigger and shooting with a gun, their mashuga. That was the day when, on the way back home, they passed a handmade sign on the road by the Congregational Church that said, "Tent Sale." And Mary had begged the Swede in her fervent way to stop and buy one for her. If Jesse could cry on his father's shoulder over waving goodbye to a family at the age of 13, about being shipped off alone at 13 with nothing but a horse, why shouldn't that memory of his, "Daddy, stop, they're selling tents," bring the Swede to the edge of tears about his daughter, the Giant, when she was 6? Figuring that Orcutt ought to know what was happening to Jesse, and needing time to collect himself, feeling suddenly the full weight of the situation he was so strenuously working to obliterate from his thinking, at least until the guest went home, the situation he was in as the father of a daughter who had killed not just one person, more or less accidentally, but, in the name of truth and justice, 3 more people quite indifferently. A daughter who, having repudiated everything she had ever learned from him and her mother, had now gone on to disown virtually the whole of civilized existence, beginning with cleanliness and ending with reason. The Swede left his father temporarily to tend alone to Jesse and went around by way of the back of the house to the rear kitchen door to get Orcutt. Through the door's glass panes, he could see a stack of papers on the table, a new batch of Orcutt's drawings, probably of the troublesome link, and then, by the sink, he saw Orcutt himself. Orcutt had on his raspberry-colored linen pants and, hanging clear of the pants, a loose-fitting Hawaiian shirt decorated with a colorful array of tropical flora, best described in a word favored by Sylvia Lvov for everything distasteful to her in wearing apparel, loud. Dawn maintained that the outfit was just part of that super-confident Orcutt facade by which, as a young newcomer to Old Rimrock, she had once been so ridiculously intimidated. According to Dawn's interpretation, which, when she told it to him, struck the Swede as not without a tinge still of the old resentment, the message of the Hawaiian summer shirts was simply this: "I am William Orcutt III, and I can wear what other people around here wouldn't dare to wear." "The grander you believe you are in the great world of Morris County," said Dawn, "the more flamboyant you think you can be." "The Hawaiian shirt," she said, smiling her mocking smile, "is WASP extremism. WASP motley. That's what I've learned living out here. Even the William Orcutt III's have their little pale moments of exuberance." Just the year before, the Swede's father had made a similar observation. "I've noticed this about Rich Goyim in the summertime. Comes the summer, and these reserved, correct people wear the most incredible costumes." The Swede had laughed. "It's a form of privilege," he said, repeating Dawn's line. "Is it?" asked Lulabov, laughing along with him. "Well, maybe it is," Lou concluded. "Still, I gotta hand it to this guy. You have to have guts to wear those pants and those shirts." Certainly, seeing Orcutt dressed like that down in the village, a burly guy, big and substantial looking, you would not have imagined, if you were the Swede, his paintings having that rubbed-out look as their distinctive feature. A person as unsophisticated about abstract art as the Swede was said to be by Dawn might easily have imagined the guy who went everywhere in those shirts as painting pictures like the famous one of Firpo knocking Dempsey out of the ring in the second round at the old Polo Grounds. But then, artistic creation obviously was not achieved in any way or for any of the reasons Swede Lvov could understand. According to the Swede's interpretation, all of the guy's effervescence seemed rather to go into wearing those shirts. All his flamboyance, his boldness, his defiance, and perhaps to his disappointment and his despair. Well, perhaps not all, the Swede discovered as he stood peering in through the kitchen door from the big granite step outside. Why he hadn't just opened the door and gone straight ahead into his own kitchen to say that Jessie was in serious need of a husband was because of the way that Orcutt was leaning over Dawn while Dawn was leaning over the sink, shucking the corn. In the first instant, it looked to the Swede, despite the fact that Dawn needed no such instruction, as though Orcutt was showing Dawn how to shuck corn, bending over her from behind and, with his hands on hers, helping her get the knack of cleanly removing the husk and the silk. But if he was only helping her learn to shuck corn, why, beneath the florid expanse of Hawaiian shirt, were his hips and his buttocks moving like that? Why was his cheek pressed against hers like that? And why was Dawn saying, if the Swede was correctly reading her lips, "Not here, not here"? Why not shuck the corn here? The kitchen was as good a place as any. Now, it took a moment to figure out that, one, they were not merely shucking corn together, and, two, not all of the effervescence, flamboyance, boldness, defiance, disappointment, and despair nibbling at the edges of the old line durability was necessarily sated by wearing those shirts. So this was why she was always losing her patience with Orcutt, to put me off the track, making cracks about his bloodlessness, his breeding, his empty warmth, putting him down like that whenever we are about to get into bed. Sure, she talks that way. She has to. She's in love with him. The unfaithfulness to the house was never unfaithfulness to the house. It was unfaithfulness. The poor wife doesn't drink for no reason, always holding everything back, so busy being so polite, Dawn said, so Princeton, Dawn said, so unerring. He works so hard to be one-dimensional. That wasp blandness, living completely off what they once were. The man is simply not there half the time. Well, Orcutt was there now, right there. What the Swede believed he'd seen before quickly turning back to the terrace and the steak on the fire was Orcutt putting himself exactly where he intended to be while telling Dawn exactly where he was. There. 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 And he did not appear to be holding anything back. At dinner, outdoors on the back terrace, with darkness coming on so gradually that the evening seemed to the Swede stalled, stopped, suspended, provoking in him a distressing sense of nothing more to follow, of nothing ever to happen again, of having entered a coffin carved out of time from which he would never be extricated. There were also the Umanovs, Marsha and Barry, and the Saltzmans, Sheila and Shelley. Only a few hours had passed since the Swede learned that it was Sheila Saltzman, the speech therapist who had hidden Mary after the bombing. The Saltzmans had not told him. And if only they had called when she showed up there, done their duty to him, then he could not complete the thought. If he were to contemplate head-on all that would not have happened had Mary never been permitted to become a fugitive from justice, couldn't complete that thought either. He sat at dinner, eternally inert, immobilized, ineffectual, inert, estranged from those expansive blessings of openness and vigor conferred on him by his hyper-optimism. A lifetime's agility as a businessman, as an athlete, as a U.S. Marine, had in no way conditioned him for being a captive, confined to a futureless box where he was not to think about what had become of his daughter, was not to think about how the Saltzmans had assisted her, was not to think about what had become of his wife. He was supposed to get through dinner, not thinking about the only things he could think about. He was supposed to do this forever. However much he might crave to get out, he was to remain stopped dead in the moment in that box. Otherwise, the world would explode. Barry Umanov, once the Swede's teammate and closest high school friend, was a law professor at Columbia, and whenever the folks flew up from Florida, Barry and his wife were invited for dinner. Seeing Barry always made his father happy, in part because Barry, the son of an immigrant tailor, had evolved into a university professor, but also because Lulavov, wrongly, though the Swede pretended not to care, credited Barry Umanov with getting Seymour to lay down his baseball glove and enter the business. Every summer, Lou reminded Barry, counselor, as he had been calling him since high school, of the good deed Barry had done for the Lavov family by the example of his professional seriousness. And Barry would say that if he had been 100th the ball player the Swede was, nobody would have gotten him near a law school. It was Barry and Marcia Umanov with whom Mary had stayed overnight a couple of times in New York before the Swede finally forbade her going into New York at all. And it was Barry from whom the Swede had sought legal advice after Mary's disappearance from Old Grimrock. Barry took him to meet Shevitz, the Manhattan litigator. When the Swede asked Shevitz to level with him what was the worst that could be laid on his daughter if she was apprehended and found guilty, he was told 7 to 10 years. But, said Shevitz, if it's done in the passion of the anti-war movement, if it's done accidentally, if everything was done to try to prevent anyone from getting hurt, and do we know she did it alone? We don't. Do we even know she did it? We don't. No significant political history, a lot of rhetoric, a lot of violent rhetoric, but is this a kid who, on her own, would kill someone deliberately? How do we know she made the bomb or set the bomb? To make a bomb, you have to be fairly sophisticated. Could this kid light a match? She was excellent in science, the Swede said. For her chemistry project, she got an A. Did she make a bomb for her chemistry project? No, of course not. No, then we don't know, do we, whether she could light a match or not. It might have been all rhetoric to her. We don't know what she did, and we don't know what she meant to do. We don't know anything, and neither does anyone else. She could have won the Westinghouse Science Prize, and we wouldn't know. What can be proved? Probably very little. The worst, since you ask me, is 7 to 10, but let's assume she's treated as a juvenile. Under juvenile law, she gets 2 to 3, and even if she pleads guilty to something, the record is sealed and nobody can get at it. Look, it all depends on her role in the homicide. It doesn't have to be too bad. If the kid will come in, even if she did have something to do with it, we might get her off with practically nothing. And until a few hours ago, when he learned that on the Oregon commune, making bombs was her specialty, when from her own unstuttering mouth he heard that it was not a single, possibly accidental death for which she was responsible, but the cold-hearted murder of 4 people, Shevitz's words was sometimes all he had to keep him from giving up hope. This man didn't deal in fairy tales. You could see that as soon as you walked into his office, Shevitz was somebody who liked to be proved right, somebody whose wish to prevail was his vocation. Barry had made it clear beforehand that Shevitz was not a guy interested in making people feel good. He was not addressing the Swede's yearnings when he said, if the kid will come in, we might get her off. But this was back when they thought they could find a jury that would believe she didn't know how to light a match. This was before 5 o'clock that afternoon. Barry's wife, Marcia, a literature professor in New York, was by even the Swede's generous estimate a difficult person. A militant nonconformist of staggering self-certainty, much given to sarcasm and calculatedly apocalyptic pronouncements designed to bring discomfort to the lords of the earth. There was nothing she did or said that didn't make clear where she stood. She had barely to move a muscle, swallow while you were speaking,
tap with a fingernail on the arm of her chair, even nod her head, as if she were in total agreement to inform you that nothing you were saying was correct. To encompass all her convictions, she dressed in large block-printed kaftans, an extensive woman, for whom a disheveled appearance was less a protest against convention than a sign that she was a thinker who got right to the point. No nonsense, no commonplace stood between her and the harshest truths. Yet, Barry enjoyed her, since they couldn't have been more dissimilar. Perhaps theirs was one of those so-called attractions of opposites. In Barry, there was such thoughtfulness and kindly concern ever since he was a kid, and the poorest kid the suite had known. He'd been a diligent, upright gentleman, a solid catcher in baseball, eventually the class valedictorian, who, after a stint in the service, went to NYU on the GI Bill. That's where he met and married Marcia Schwartz. It was hard for the suite to understand how a strongly built, not unhandsome guy like Barry could free himself at the age of 22 from the desire to be with anybody else in the world but Marcia Schwartz. Already so opinionated as a college girl that the suite had to battle in her presence to stay awake. Yet Barry liked her, sat there and listened to her. Didn't at all seem to care that she was a slob, dressed even in college like somebody's grandmother and with those buoyant eyes unnervingly enlarged by the heavy spectacles. Dawn's opposite in every way. For Marcia to have spawned a self-styled revolutionary, yes. Had Mary been raised within earshot of Marcia's mouth, but Dawn? Pretty? Petite? Unpolitical? Dawn? Why Dawn? Where do you look for the cause? Where's the explanation for this mismatch? Was it nothing more than a trick played by their genes? During the march on the Pentagon, the march to stop the war in Vietnam, Marcia Yumanov had been thrown into a paddy wagon with some 20 other women and, very much to her liking, locked up overnight in a D.C. jail where she didn't stop talking protest talk till they were all let out in the morning. If Mary had been her daughter, things would make sense. If only Mary had fought a war of words, fought the world with words alone like this strident Yenta, then Mary's would not be a story that begins and ends with a bomb but another story entirely. Bomb? A bomb? A bomb tells the whole fucking story. Hard to grasp Barry's marrying that woman. Maybe it had to do with his family's being so poor. Who knows? Her animus, her superior airs, the sense she gave of being unclean, everything intolerable to the suite in a friend, let alone in a mate, well, those were the very characteristics that seemed to enliven Barry's appreciation of his wife. It was a puzzle, it truly was, how one perfectly reasonable man could adore what a second perfectly reasonable man couldn't abide for half an hour. But just because it was a puzzle, the Swede tried his best to restrain his aversion and neutralize his judgment and see Marcia Yumanov as simply an oddball from another world, the academic world, the intellectual world, where always to be antagonizing people and challenging whatever they said was apparently looked on with admiration. What it was they got out of being so negative was beyond him. It seemed to him far more productive when everybody grew up and got over that. Still, that didn't mean that Marsh was really out to needle people and work them over just because she was so often needling people and working them over. He couldn't call her vicious once he recognized that this was the way she was accustomed to socializing in Manhattan. Moreover, he couldn't believe that Barry Yumanov, who at one time was closer to him than his own kid brother, could marry someone vicious. As usual, the Swede's default reaction to not being able to fathom cause and effect, as opposed to his father's reflexive suspiciousness, was to fall back on a lifelong strategy and become tolerant and charitable. And so, he was content to chalk up Marcia as difficult, allowing at worst, well, let's just say she's no bargain. But Dawn loathed her. Loathed her because she knew herself to be loathed by Marcia, for having been Miss New Jersey. Dawn couldn't stand people who made that story the whole of her story. And Marcia was especially exasperating because the pleasure of explaining Dawn by a story that had never explained her, and hardly explained her now, was so smugly exhibited. When they'd all first met, Dawn told the Umanovs about her father's heart attack and how no money was coming into the house and how she realized that the door to college was about to be slammed shut on her brother. The whole scholarship story. But none of it made Miss New Jersey seem like anything but a joke to Marcia Umanov. Marcia barely bothered to hide the fact that when she looked at Dawn Lavov, she saw no one there. That she thought Dawn pretentious for raising cows. Thought she was doing it for the image. It wasn't a serious operation. Dawn ran 12, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. As far as Marcia was concerned, it was a pretty house and garden fantasy contrived by a rich, silly woman who lived not in stinky, smelling New Jersey, no, who lived in the country. Dawn loathed Marcia because of her undisguised superiority to the Lavov's wealth, to their taste, to the rural way of life they loved, and loathed her beyond loathing because she was convinced that privately, Marcia was altogether pleased about what Mary was alleged to have done. The privileged place in Marcia's feelings went to the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese. She never for a moment compromised her political convictions or her compassionate comprehension of international affairs, not even when she saw from 6 inches away the misery that had befallen her husband's oldest friend. And this was what led Dawn to make the accusations that the Swede knew to be false. Not because he could swear to Marcia's honorableness, but because for him the probity of Barry Umanov was beyond question. "I will not have her in this house. A pig has more humanity in her than that woman does. I don't care how many degrees she has. She is callous and she is blind. She is the most blind, self-involved, narrow-minded, obnoxious, so-called intelligent person I have ever met in my life, and I will not have her in my house." Well, I can't very well ask Barry to come by himself. Then Barry can't come. Barry has to come. I want Barry to come. My father gets a terrific boot out of seeing Barry here. He expects to see Barry here. It's Barry, Dawn, who got me to Shevitz. But that woman took Mary in. Don't you see? That's where Mary went. To New York, to them. That's who gave her a hiding place. Somebody did. Somebody had to. A real bomb throw in her house. That excited her. She hid her from us, hid Mary from her parents when she needed her parents most. Marcia Umanov is the one who sent her underground. Mary didn't want to stay there even before. She stayed exactly twice at Barry's. That was it. The third time, she never showed up. You don't remember. She went somewhere else to stay and never showed up at the Umanovs again. Marcia is the one, Seymour. Who else has her connections? Wonderful father this one, wonderful father that one, pouring blood on the draft records. So cozy she is with her war-resistant priests. So buddy-buddy. But they're not priests, Seymour. Priests are not great forward-thinking liberals. Otherwise, they don't become priests. It's just that that's not what priests are supposed to do. No more than they're supposed to stop praying for the boys who go over there. What she likes about these priests is that these aren't priests. She doesn't love them because they're in church. She loves them because they are doing something that, in her estimation, taints the church. Because they are doing something outside the church, outside the regular role of the priests. That these priests are an affront to what people like me grew up with, that's what she likes. That's what this fat bitch likes about everything. I hate her. I hate her guts. Fine. Fine with me. Hate her all you want, he said. But not for something she hasn't done. She didn't do it, Dawn. You're driving yourself crazy with something that cannot be true. And it wasn't true. It wasn't Marcia who had taken Mary in. Marcia was all talk, always had been. Senseless, ostentatious talk, words with the sole purpose of scandalously exhibiting themselves. Uncompromising, quarrelsome words expressing little more than Marcia's intellectual vanity and her odd belief that all her posturing added up to an independent mind. It was Sheila Salzman who'd taken Mary in. The Morristown speech therapist, the pretty, kindly, soft-spoken young woman who for a while had given Mary so much hope and confidence. The teacher who provided Mary all those strategies to outwit her impediment and replaced Audrey Hepburn as her heroine. In the months when Dawn was on sedatives and was in and out of the hospital, in the months before Sheila and the Swede would back off from ignoring the whole responsible orientation of their lives, in the months before these two well-ordered, well-behaved people could bring themselves to stop endangering their precious stability, Sheila Salzman had been Sweet Lvov's mistress, the first and last mistress. A most unsweet-like acquisition. Incongruous, implausible, even ridiculous. Mistress does not quite make sense in the untarnished context of that life, and yet, for the 4 months after Mary disappeared, that is what Sheila was to him. At dinner, the conversation was about Watergate and about Deep Throat. Except for the Swede's parents and the Orcutts, everybody at the table had been to see the X-rated movie starring a young porno actress named Linda Lovelace. The picture was no longer playing only in the adult houses, but had become a sensation in neighborhood theaters all over Jersey. What surprised him, Shelley Salzman was saying, was that the electorate, who overwhelmingly chose as president and vice president Republican politicians hypocritically pretending to deep moral piety, should make a hit out of a movie that so graphically caricatured acts of oral sex. Maybe it's not the same people, said Dawn, who are going to the movie. It's McGovernites, Marcia Umanov asked her. At this table it is, answered Dawn, already inflamed at the outset of dinner by this woman she could not bear. Please, said the Swede's father. What these two things have got to do with each other is a mystery to me. I don't know why you people pay good money to go to that trash in the first place. It's pure trash, am I right, counselor? He looked to Barry for support. It's a kind of trash, Barry said. Then why do you let it into your lives? It leaks in, Mr. Lvov, Bill Orcutt said to him pleasantly, whether we like it or not. Whatever is out there leaks in. It pours in. It's not the same out there anymore, in case you haven't heard.
Oh, I heard, sir. I come from the late city of Newark. I heard more than I want to hear. Look, the Irish ran the city, the Italians ran the city, now let the colored run the city. That's not my point. I got nothing against that. It's the colored people's turn to reach into the till. I wasn't born yesterday. In Newark, corruption is the name of the game. What is new, number one, is race. Number two, taxes. Add that to the corruption, there's your problem. $7.76. That is the tax rate in the city of Newark. I don't care how big you are or how small you are. I'm here to tell you that you cannot run a business with those kind of taxes. General Electric already moved out in 1953. GE, Westinghouse, Breyers down on Raymond Boulevard, Cellulite, all left the city. Every one of them big employees, and before the riots, before the racial hatred, they got out. Race is just the icing on the cake. Streets aren't cleaned, burned out cars nobody takes away, people in abandoned buildings, fires in abandoned buildings, unemployment, filth, more poverty, schooling, non-existent, schools, a disaster. On every street corner, dropouts. Dropouts, doing nothing. Dropouts, dealing drugs. Dropouts, looking for trouble. The projects don't get put. Don't get me started on the projects. Police on the take, every kind of disease known to man. As far back as the summer of 64, I told my son, Seymour, get out. Get out, I said. But he won't listen. Patterson goes up, Elizabeth goes up, Jersey City goes up. You got to be blind in both eyes not to see what's next. And I told this to Seymour. Newark is the next watch. I told him. You heard it here first. The summer of 67. I predicted it in those very words. Didn't I, Seymour? Called it practically to the day.
That is true, the Swede acknowledged.
Manufacturing is finished in Newark. Newark is finished. The riots were just as bad, if not worse, in Washington and Los Angeles and Detroit. But mark my words, Newark will be the city that never comes back. It can't. And gloves in America, kaput, also finished. Only my son hangs on. 5 more years, and outside of the government contracts, there won't be a pair of gloves made in America. Not in Puerto Rico either. They're already in the Philippines, the big boys. It will be India, it will be Indonesia, Pakistan, Bangladesh. You'll see every place around the world making gloves except here. The union alone didn't break us, however. Sure, the union didn't understand, but some of the manufacturers didn't understand either. I wouldn't pay the sons of a bitches another 5 cents, and here the guy is driving a Cadillac and sitting in Florida in the winter. No, a lot of manufacturers didn't think straight, but the unions never understood the competition from overseas, and there is no doubt in my mind that the unions speeded up the demise of the glove industry by being tough and making it so that people couldn't make money. The union rate on piecework ran a lot of people out of business or offshore. In the 30s, our competition was heavy from Czechoslovakia, from Austria, from Italy. The war came along and saved us. Government contracts, 77 million pairs of gloves purchased by the quartermaster. The glove man got rich, but then the war ended, and I tell you, as far back as that, even in the good old days, it was already the beginning of the end. Our downfall was that we could never compete with overseas. We hastened it because there wasn't some good judgment on either side. But it could not be saved regardless. The only thing that could have stopped it, and I was not for this, I don't think you can stop world trade, and I don't think you should try, but the only thing that could have stopped it is if we put up trade barriers, making it not just 5% duties, but 30%, 40%. Lou, said his wife, what does any of this have to do with this movie? This movie? These goddamn movies? Well, of course, they're not new either, you know. We had a Pinochle Club. This is years ago. You remember the Friday Night Club? And we had a guy in the electrical business? You remember, Seymour. Abe Sachs? Sure, the Swede said. Well, I hate to tell you, but he had all these kinds of movies right in this house. Sure, they existed. On Mulberry Street, where we used to go with the kids to eat chinks, was a saloon where you could go in and you buy whatever filth you wanted. And you know something? I watched 5 minutes, and I went back in the kitchen, and to his credit, so did my dear friend. He's dead now. He's a wonderful fellow. My mind has gone to Glovka. What the hell was his... was it Al Haberman? Said his wife. Right. The two of us just played gin for an hour until there was this hullabaloo in the living room where they were showing the movie. And what happened was the whole damn movie, the camera, the whole, what do you call it, caught fire. I couldn't have been happy. That is 30, 40 years ago. And to this day, I remember sitting with Al Haberman playing cards while the rest of them were drooling like idiots in the living room. He was by now telling this to Orcutt, directing his remarks solely at him. As though, despite the evidence of the drunken woman Lulavov was sitting next to, despite the incontrovertible evidence of so much of Jewish lore, the anarchy of a high-born Gentile remained essentially unimaginable to him. And Orcutt, therefore, of everyone at the table, could best appreciate the platitude he was getting at. They're supposed to be the dependable ones in control of themselves, aren't they? They marked the territory, didn't they? They made the rules, the very rules that the rest of us who came here have agreed to follow. Could Orcutt fail to admire him for sitting in that kitchen, sitting there patiently playing gin, until at last the forces of good overcame the forces of evil, and that dirty movie went up in smoke back in 1935? Well, I'm sorry to say, Mr. Lebov, that you can't keep it out any longer just by playing cards, Orcutt told him. That was a way to keep it out that doesn't exist any longer.
Keep what out? Lou Lebov asked.
What you're talking about, said Orcutt. The permissiveness. Abnormality cloaked his ideology. The perpetual protest. Time was you could step away from it. You could make a stand against it. As you point out, you could even just play cards against it. But these days it's getting harder and harder to find relief. The grotesque is supplanting everything commonplace that people love about this country. Today, to be what they call repressed is a source of shame to people. As not to be repressed used to be.
That is true.
Let me tell you about Al Haberman. You know, you want to talk about the old style world and what used to be? Let's talk about Al. A wonderful fellow. Al, a handsome fellow. Got rich cutting gloves. You could in those days. A husband and wife who had any ambition could get a few skins and make some gloves ended up in a small room. Two men cutting, a couple of women sewing. They could make gloves. They could press them and ship them. They made money. They were their own bosses. They could work 60 hours a week. Way back when Henry Ford was paying the unheard of sum of $1 a day, a fine table cutter would make $5 a day. But look, in those days, it was nothing for an ordinary woman to own 20, 25 pairs of gloves. Quite common. A woman used to have a glove wardrobe, different gloves for every outfit, different colors, different styles, different lengths. A woman wouldn't go outside without a pair in any weather. In those days, it wasn't unusual for a woman to spend 2 or 3 hours at the glove cut and try on 30 pairs of gloves. And the lady behind the desk had a sink, and she would wash her hands between each color. In a fine lady's glove, we had quarter sizes into the 4s and up to 8.5. Glove cutting is a wonderful trade. Was, anyway. Everything now is was. A cutter like Al always had a shirt and tie, and in those days, a cutter never worked without a shirt and tie. You could work at 75 and 80 years old, too. They could start in the way Al did, at 15 or even younger, and they could go to 80. 70 was a spring chicken, and they could work at their leisure, Saturday and Sunday. These people could work constantly, money to send their kids to school, money to fix up their homes nicely. Al could take a piece of leather, say to me, for a gag, what do you want, Lou? 8 9/16, and just snip it off without the ruler, measuring it perfectly with just his eye. The cutter was the prima donna. But all that pride of craftsmanship is gone, of course, of the actual table cutters who could cut a 16-button white glove. I think Al Haberman may have been the last guy in America who could do it. The long glove, of course, vanished. Another was. There was the 8-button glove, which became very popular silk line, but that was gone by 65. We were already taking gloves that were longer, chopping off the tops, making shorties, and using the top to make another glove. From this point, where the thumb seam is, every inch on out, they used to put a button. So we still talk, in terms of length, of buttons. Thank God in 1960, Jackie Kennedy walked out there with a little glove to the wrist, and a glove to the elbow, and a glove above the elbow, and a pillbox hat, and all of a sudden, gloves were in style again. First lady of the glove industry wore a size 6.5. People in the glove industry were praying to that lady. She herself stocked up in Paris, but so what? That woman put the lady's fine leather glove back on the map. But when they assassinated Kennedy and Jacqueline Kennedy left the White House, that and the miniskirt was the end of the lady's fashion glove. The assassination of John F. Kennedy and the arrival of the miniskirt, and together, that was the death knell for the lady's dress glove. Till then, it was a 12-month, year-round business. There was a time when a woman would not go out unless she wore a pair of gloves, even in the spring and the summer. Now the glove is for cold weather, or for driving, or for sports. Lou, his wife said, nobody is talking about... Let me finish, please. Please, don't interrupt me, please. Al Haberman was a great reader. No schooling, but he loved to read. His favorite author was Sir Walter Scott, and Sir Walter Scott, in one of his classic books, gets an argument going between the glove maker and the shoemaker about who is the better craftsman, and the glove maker wins the argument. You know what he says? All you do, he tells the shoemaker, is make a mitten for the foot. You don't have to articulate around each toe. But Sir Walter Scott was the son of a glover, so it makes sense he would win the argument. You didn't know Sir Walter Scott was the son of a glover? You know who else, aside from Sir Walter and my two sons? William Shakespeare. Father was a glover who couldn't read and write his own name. You know what Romeo says to Juliet when she's up on the balcony? Everybody knows. Romeo, Romeo, where are you, Romeo? That she says. But what does Romeo say? I started in a tannery when I was 13, but I can answer for you because of my friend Al Haberman, who since has passed away, unfortunately. 73 years old, he came out of the house, slipped on the ice, broke his neck. Terrible. He told me this. Romeo says, see the way she leans her cheek on her hand? I only wish I was the glove on that hand so I could touch that cheek. Shakespeare, most famous author in history. Lou, dear, Sylvia LaBeouf said again softly, what does this have to do with what everybody is talking about? Please, he said, and impatiently, with one hand, without even looking at her, waved away her objection. And McGovern, he went on, this is an idea I don't follow at all. What does McGovern have to do with that lousy movie? I voted for McGovern. I campaigned in the whole condominium for McGovern. You should hear what I put up with from Jewish people, how Nixon was this for Israel and that for Israel. And I reminded them, in case they forgot, that Harry Truman had him pegged for Tricky Dicky back in 1948. And now look, the reward they're reaping, my good friends, who voted for Mr. Von Nixon and his stormtroopers. Let me tell you who goes to those movies. Riffraff, bums, and kids without adult supervision. Why my son takes his lovely wife to such a movie is something I'll go to my grave not understanding. To see, said Marcia, how the other half lives. My daughter-in-law is a lady. She has no interest in those things. Lou, his wife said to him, maybe not everybody sees it your way. I cannot believe that. These are intelligent, educated people. You put too much stock in intelligence, Marcia teased him. It doesn't annihilate human nature. That's human nature, those movies. Tell me, what do you tell your children about the movie when they ask that it's good, wholesome fun? You don't have to tell them a thing, Marcia said. They don't ask. These days, they just go. And what puzzled him, of course, was that what was happening these days did not seem to displease her. A professor. A Jewish professor. With children. I wouldn't say children are going, Shelley Salzman put in, as much seemingly to disrupt the unpromising dialogue as to give comfort to the Swede's father. I would say adolescents. And Dr. Salzman, you approve of this? Shelley smiled at the title Lou LaBeouf insisted on using with him after all these years. Shelley was a pale, plump, round-shouldered man in a bow tie and a seersucker jacket, a hard-working family doctor
who couldn't keep the kindness out of his voice. The pallor and the posture, the old-fashioned steel-rimmed glasses, the hairless crown of his head, the wiry white curls above his ears, this unstudied lack of luster had made the Swede feel particularly sorry for him during the months of the love affair with Sheila Salzman. Yet he, nice Dr. Salzman, had harbored Mary in his house, hidden her not only from the FBI, but from him, her father, the person she needed most in the world. And I was the one, the Swede was thinking, guilty over my secret. Even as Shelley was gently saying to the Swede's father, "My approval or disapproval is beside the point of whether they go to those movies or not." When Dawn had first proposed going for a facelift to the clinic of a Geneva doctor that she had read about in Vogue, a doctor they didn't know, a procedure they knew nothing about, the Swede had quietly contacted Shelley Salzman and went off to see him alone in his office. Their own family doctor was a man the Swede respected, a cautious and thorough elderly man who would have counseled the Swede and answered his questions and tried, on the Swede's behalf, to dissuade Dawn from the idea. But instead, the Swede had called Shelley and asked if he might come over to talk about a family problem. Only when he got to Shelley's office did he understand that he had gone there to confess, 4 years after the fact, to having had the affair with Sheila in the aftermath of Mary's disappearance. When Shelley smiled and asked, "How can I help you?" the Swede found himself on the brink of saying, "By forgiving me." Throughout the conversation, every time the Swede spoke, he had to quash the impulse to tell Shelley everything, to say, "I'm not here because of the facelift. I'm here because I did what I should never have done. I betrayed my wife. I betrayed you. I betrayed myself." But saying this would be a betrayal of Sheila, would it not? He could no more justify his taking it solely upon himself to confess to a husband than he could had she taken it upon herself to confess to his wife. However much he might yearn to be rid of a secret that stained and oppressed him, and imagine that a confession might unburden him, did he have the right to free himself at Sheila's expense? At Shelley's expense? At Dawn's expense? No. There was such a thing as ethical stability. No, he could not be so ruthlessly self-regarding. A cheap stunt, a treacherous stunt, and one that probably wouldn't pay off in long-term relief. Yet each time the Swede opened his mouth to speak, he needed desperately to say to this kindly man, "I was the lover of your wife." To seek from Shelley Salzman the magical restitution of equilibrium that Dawn must be hoping she'd find in Geneva. But instead, he only told Shelley how against the facelift he was, only enumerated his reasons against it, and then, to his surprise, listened to Shelley telling him that Dawn had perhaps begun to entertain a potentially promising idea. "If she thinks this will help her start over again," Shelley said, "why not give her the opportunity? Why not give this woman every opportunity? There's nothing wrong with it, Seymour. This is life. Not a life sentence, but life. Nothing immoral about having a facelift, nothing frivolous about a woman wanting one. She found the idea in Vogue magazine. That shouldn't throw you off. She only found what she was looking for. You don't know how many women come to me who've been through a terrible trauma, and they want to talk about something or rather, and what turns out to be on their mind is just this, plastic surgery and without Vogue magazine. The emotional and psychological implications can turn out to be something. The relief they get, those that get relief, is not to be minimized. I can't say I know how it happens. I'm not saying it always happens, but I've seen it happen again and again. Women who have lost their husbands, who've been seriously ill. You don't look like you believe me." But the Swede knew what he looked like a man with Sheila written all over his face. "I know," said Shelley. "It seems like a purely physical way of dealing with something profoundly emotional, but for many people it's a wonderful survival strategy. And Dawn may be one of them. I don't think you want to be puritanical about this. If Dawn feels strongly about a facelift, and if you were to go along with her, if you were to support her..." Later that same day, Shelley phoned the Swede at the factory. He made some inquiries about Dr. LaPlante. "We've got people as good as him here, I'm sure, but if you want to go to Switzerland and get away and let her recuperate there, why not? This LaPlante is tops.
Shelley, thanks. It's awfully kind of you, said the Swede, disliking himself more than ever in the light of Shelley's generosity. And yet, this was the same guy who, with his co-conspirator wife, had provided Mary a hiding place, not only from the FBI, but from her father and mother. A fact about as fantastic as a fact could be. What kind of mask is everyone wearing? I thought these people were on my side. But the mask is all that's on my side. That's it. For 4 months, I wore the mask myself, with him, with my wife. And I could not stand it. I went there to tell him that I'd betrayed him, and only didn't so as not to compound the betrayal, and never once did he let on how cruelly he betrayed me. My approval or disapproval, Shelley had been saying to Lulavov, is beside the point of whether they go to those movies or not. But you're a physician, the Swede's father insisted. A respected person, an ethical person, a responsible person. Lou, said his wife, maybe, dear, you're monopolizing the conversation. Let me finish, please. To the table at large, he asked, Am I monopolizing the conversation? Absolutely not, said Marcia, throwing an arm good-naturedly across his back. It's delightful to hear your delusions. I don't know what that means, he told her. It means social conditions may have altered in America since you were taking the kids to eat at the Chinks, and Al Haberman was cutting gloves in a shirt and tie. Really, Dawn said to her, they've altered? Nobody told us. And to contain herself, got up and left for the kitchen. Waiting there for Dawn's instructions were a couple of local high school girls who helped to do the serving and the cleaning up whenever the Lvovs had dinner guests.
Marcia was to one side of Lou Lvov, Jesse Orcutt to the other. Jesse's new glass of scotch, which she must have managed to pour for herself in the kitchen, he had picked up from her place and moved out of her reach only minutes into the cold cucumber soup. When she then made a move to leave the table, he would not allow her to get up. Just sit, he told her. Sit and eat. You don't need that. You need food. Eat your dinner. Each time she so much as shifted in her chair, he laid a hand firmly on hers to remind her she was going nowhere. A dozen candles burned in two tall ceramic candelabra, and to the Swede, who sat flanked by his mother and Sheila Saltzman, everyone's eyes, deceptively enough, even Marcia's eyes, appeared blessed in that light with spiritual understanding, with kindly lucidity, alive with all the meaning one so craves to find in one's friends. Sheila, like Barry, was on hand every year at Labor Day because of what she had come to mean to his folks. On the phone to Florida, the Swede almost never got through a conversation without his father's asking, and how is that lovely Sheila, that lovely woman, how is she doing? She's such a dignified woman, his mother said. Such a refined person. Isn't she Jewish, darling? Your father says no. He insists she isn't. Why this disagreement should persist for years, he couldn't understand exactly. But the subject of fair-haired Sheila Saltzman's religious origins had proved indispensable to his parents' lives. To Dawn, who'd been trying for decades to be as tolerant of the Swede's imperfect parents as he was of her imperfect mother, this was their most inexplicable preoccupation. Their most enraging as well, particularly as Dawn knew that, for her adolescent daughter, Sheila had something Dawn didn't have, that somehow Mary had come to trust the speech therapist in a way she no longer trusted her mother. Are there no Jewish blondes in the world other than you? Dawn asked him. It hasn't anything to do with her appearance, the Swede explained. It has to do with Mary. What does her being Jewish have to do with Mary? I don't know. She was the speech therapist. They're in awe of her, the Swede said, because of all she did for Mary. She wasn't the child's mother by any chance, or was she? They know that, darling, calmly answered the Swede. But because of the speech therapy, they've made her into some kind of magician. And so had he. Not so much while she was Mary's therapist, when he had merely found her composure a curious stimulus to sexual imaginings, but after Mary disappeared and grief absconded with his wife. Thrown violently off his own narrow perch, he felt an intangible need open hugely within him, a need with no bottom to it, and he yielded to a solution so foreign to him that he didn't even recognize how improbable it was. And the quiet, thoughtful woman, who had once made Mary less strange to herself by teaching her how to overcome her word phobias and to control the elaborate circumlocutionary devices that, paradoxically, only increased her child's sense of being out of control, was someone he found himself wanting to incorporate into himself. The man who had lived correctly within marriage for almost 20 years was determined to be senselessly, worshipfully in love. It was 3 months before he could begin to understand that this was no way around anything, and it was Sheila who had to tell him. He hadn't gotten a romantic mistress.